We haven't really been doing much of a review. I do have a ton of material to get through this morning, 31 chapters, about a minute a chapter maybe, so we'll race through it. But I do want to do a bit of a review. What did Augustine cover in book one? Okay, his infancy and one other portion of his life. He talked about his childhood education. Right, remember he got beat at school a lot, right? And his parents thought that was funny because they got beat when they were in school, right? So those are the two incidents that he talks about in book one. What does he talk about in book two? There's kind of two primary things he talks about in book two as well. He talks about the lusts of young manhood, let's say. And then the really heinous act of stealing some pears. Okay, those are the two big incidents in book two. What did he talk about in book three? Did that last week. Talked about his college years. He went from Thagaste to Carthage to the big city to learn rhetoric. And so he's there. And he talks about his first conversion. He doesn't use that terminology, but most of the commentators do. They speak of kind of three conversions for Augustine. What was his first conversion? He read a book. Yeah. He read a book that, you know, has been lost to history called the Hortensius. And he kind of went to college with zero purpose, right? I mean, he's going to school because you got to learn, you got to get a job. That's what mom and dad want. He doesn't have a whole lot of purpose in life other than fulfilling his lusts. And he reads Cicero's Hortensius, which is a call to pursue truth, to live for something more than yourself. And it drastically changes him. It changes his affections and what he desires. He's still got all the lusts, but he does kind of want something more. He knows there's something greater to be pursued. Then he talks about falling into the Manichaean cult. He was unimpressed with Scripture, and they kind of pointed and poked some holes in Scripture, and he bought it hook, line, and sinker and fell into that. And then at the end of that chapter, we see Monica, or at the end of that book, the last three chapters, Monica's praying consistently and weeping for her son because she now sees that the way he's living ends in death. And he sees her praying. He sees her crying and weeping for his soul. She has a dream that she's standing on a ruler. He's standing next to her. And the angel tells her, where you are, he will be also. She takes great confidence in that, but doesn't stop praying for him. And then she goes to the local pastor, the bishop, and says, can you go talk to my knucklehead son? Right? Can you get him out of this Manichaean cult? And what does the pastor tell her? No. Because it's not going to do any good. And I was in that same cult for a long time. He's going to have to just keep reading until he realizes it's dumb. And comes out of it on his own. But she persists. Because she's a mom, and she loves him, and she's concerned for his soul. So finally he tells her, look, the son of so many tears can't be lost. And she takes that as a prophecy from God, and she goes away. But she never stops praying for him, and weeping for him, and pleading with him. She ends up living with him at this point, and staying with him, which is significant, as we'll talk about this morning. So when we come to book four, just to give you a very rough, simple outline, we've got a young man who's graduated college. He comes back home to his hometown where he's a teacher and a public figure. We find the bulk of this chapter is talking about the death of a beloved friend. He has some meditations that are spurred on by that death on what is love, what is friendship, what is grief. And then at the end, we see he's got a brilliant mind, and it's being wasted. That's the broad brush outline of book four. If we go chapter by chapter, the first chapter is kind of an intro and a transition. I want to read chapter 1 in its entirety. I think it's helpful. He says, throughout that same time, which was 9 years from the 18th year of my life, clear up to the 27th. That's the time frame we're talking in book 4. He says, we, speaking of he and his buddies, we were led and leading astray in turn. Right? They're deceived and they're deceiving others. It's the blind leading the blind. Our various passions serving as so many confidence tricks played on us and by us. This happened openly through the studies they call fit for a free man and secretly through a counterfeit religion. So he's doing all this through the good education you're supposed to get and also from the secret cult. He says, we were conceited as to the former, his education, gullible as to the latter, and fatuously full of ourselves whatever we did. Right?
Sounds pretty modern.
Sounds very modern, very much like any young teen, young adult man, right? On the one side, we ran after the inanity of public acclaim. Right? He wants recognition in the public square. And we went for nothing less than applause in the theater. Right? He's performing at this point, giving speeches and poems and these sorts of things. He wants to be recognized. For wrangling over poetry prizes, for literary Olympiads, at which you might be crowned with grass clippings. Right? You get a little laurel crown that you wear. And pageants of pure folderol, and itches and cravings without end. And yet, on the other side, we burned for a way to clear all this nasty stuff out of our systems. Right? That he does have this yearning for truth at this point that's in conflict with everything else he's doing. And because of that, in this Manichaean cult, he says, we brought goodies to those who styled themselves saints and chosen ones, so that in the workshops of their paunches, they would craft angels and gods who would set us free. I enacted all this garbage with my friends who were fooled by me and right along with me. And then, kind of speaking in the contemporary sense, as he's writing this, he says, they can go ahead and laugh at me. All those insolent people not yet flattened to the earth and smashed to pieces in wholesome fashion by you, my God. But for my part, I want to plead my humiliations because they glorify you. Right? Almost every chapter, he's reiterating, I'm not rehearsing all this stuff because it's fun. I'm not rehearsing all this stuff because I just like thinking about my sin, but because it glorifies God. He says, I beg you, let me, through today's memories, and here you really get the sense that he's orating this to a group of scribes. It's like, okay, all right, this is Tuesday, but for, you know, as I'm recalling this, Lord, through today's memories, let me tour the detours of my bygone wrongheadedness and slaughter for you a victim, which is the gift of my rejoicing. What does he mean when he talks about slaughtering for God a victim? He's talking about slaughtering himself. He's talking Romans 12, presenting himself as a living sacrifice. For what was myself without you, if not a guide over the edge of the chasm? Or what am I, doing well, but a suckling of your milk, enjoying you, the food that doesn't go bad? And who is a human being, anyone at all, as long as he's just a human being as such? Right? A human being outside of God isn't even really a human being. They're less than human in a sense. Robust, powerful personages can laugh at us in our weakness and poverty. We will testify to you. Right? He recognizes that some of his old friends think he's a nut. Right? He says, that's fine. They can think that all they want. I'm going to testify of God. In chapters 2 through 6, we get kind of just biographical sketches here of what's going on. He's a rhetorician and a teacher in Thagaste. By all outward signs, he has achieved what mom and dad wanted. Right? from the world's perspective, this is success. Right? He went off to college, came back, got the good job, and he's well known in the community. In chapter 2, we see that he's a teacher. He's teaching rhetoric. He says, "During those years, I taught the science of rhetoric and subjugated my own greed, kept my garrulity, though it was designed to subjugate others on the auction block." He's trying to profit off of his rhetorical skills. "As you know, Master, I did prefer to have good, solid, respectable students, the kind that are called good, solid, respectable at any rate. And with complete scrupulousness, I instructed them in the scams." What are the scams? Right. This is the rhetorical art, right? How can I craft an argument in such a way that I force you into a corner so that you have to do what I want you to do, right? It's a scam. He says, "Not, I mean, equipping them to put the innocent on trial for their lives." He's not trying to do that. But just to advocate for the guilty once in a while, because it's profitable. Right? He's a defense attorney at times because there's money to be made. It's a little bit ironic that Augustine here is doing exactly what he complained about his teachers doing in book one. Now, I don't know if he's beating them. Right? He does want good, respectable students, at least those thought to be good and respectable. But he's essentially just become them, become his teachers. And then we're told about his mistress and child. And it's almost like this throwaway comment that just comes in there out of nowhere. He says, "In those years, I had one woman. Not that I had acquired carnal knowledge of her in what's called a lawful union," so he wasn't married to her, "but rather my roving heat with no good sense to its name had tracked her down. But there was only one woman, and I stayed loyal to her bed. In her case, I certainly found out, on the evidence of my own experience, what a gap there is between the sanctioned scope of marriage, a bond contracted for the purpose of producing children, and a deal arising from lustful infatuation, from which progeny is born against the parents' wishes, though once it's born, it forces them to love it." There's a sense that in marriage, children are expected. It's one of the things you're looking for. But when you're not married and you're sleeping with someone, the last thing you want is a kid, generally. And this is extremely modern. It's interesting that the child wasn't put to death or aborted, because that is common in the Roman era. But once it's born, he says, it forces us to love it. Right? This is why sonograms are so important. When you see it, it's kind of hard not to love it. You recognize what it is. Well, going on in chapter 3, he enters a poetry contest. A soothsayer comes up to him and says, "If you give me some money, I'll make some sacrifices and ensure you win." And he says, "That's nonsense. I don't want to have anything to do with it." Chapter 4, he ends up in some astrological chicanery. What is astrology? The stars reveal the future, somewhat determined by the stars. And what does Augustine, reflecting back on this, say the Christian view of astrology is? He condemns it. He says, "But genuine Christian reverence does repudiate and condemn the practice." It always has, right? Why is astrology dangerous, even in our own day? Okay, it's idol worship. Why else might it be dangerous? Augustine identifies one particular issue in this chapter, and it's astrologers who will say, "Well, you did that because Mars was in this position." Right? It's the fault in our stars. Okay? You're not responsible for your actions. It was Venus in retrograde. Okay? That is dangerous. Well, he goes on from there. He meets a wise doctor in chapter 5. What does that doctor say about astrology? He says, it's nonsense. He says, I can't believe you're so smart and you're being fooled by such nonsense. But Augustine pushes back and he says, well, actually, you know, sometimes this astrology stuff works. I mean, it's predicted stuff. How do you account for that? And so how do we account for such things? What's that?
Just happenstance.
Yeah. Essentially, the doctor says, look, if you write enough stuff, you can take a random line and make it say anything you want. He says you can pull up any poet and snatch a verse out of there and twist it and turn it and make it fit wherever you want. So he says it doesn't actually prove anything. And then he's ridiculed by a friend, Nebridius, who ridiculed the whole field of prognostication, of astrology. And this is really interesting. Chapter 6 is very short. It's just two or three sentences, I think. And he mentions a friend, Nebridius, who rebukes him. That's significant because the rest of this book is going to be kind of devoted to a friend whose name he never mentions, but had a far greater impact on him than Nebridius. So in chapters 7 through 27, we see this death of a friend and meditations on love, friendship, and grief. In chapter 7, Augustine has come back home from college. He meets a boyhood friend, someone who he had been a friend with when he was growing up in Thagaste. He's back now from college. They reconnect and develop this intense friendship. And Augustine says that the friendship was excessively sweet. Why was it excessively sweet? Yeah, the thing that Augustine identifies is it was really sweet because I got him to leave Christianity. He says it was an excessively sweet friendship cooked up as it was in the heat of similar pursuits. Right? We had a lot of things in common. But excessively sweet because I turned him away from the truth, which as a youth he didn't have in his blood as part of his deeper self. He wasn't a genuine Christian, but he had been brought up in a Christian home. I led him into those superstitious, malignant, Manichaean fairy tales that made my mother mourn for me. My friend was, in his mind, lost along with me, and my soul couldn't be without him. Right? And these are bosom buddies. You know, this is Jonathan and David type friendship. Chapter 8, his friend falls ill, and he's secretly baptized. How do you secretly baptize somebody? Well, I don't think we're talking by immersion, for one. You know, probably pouring. But whatever, this guy's in a coma, he's in a fever, something. He doesn't know what's going on. And somebody comes over and baptizes him. And then he wakes up. He recovers from his illness. And what does Augustine try to do? He says, he's kind of ribbing him a little bit. Hey, man, you got baptized. What do you think of that? How does the friend respond? How dare you? Get away from me with that heresy. I'm a Christian now. Now, I don't know what happened there. I don't know if he became a true believer or if he's just putting his faith in a baptism. I don't know. But something drastic happened. Now, Augustine thinks, okay, he just woke up. We'll give it some time. He'll come to his senses. We'll have a good laugh over this. But then what happens? His friend dies. He thought he was good. And it's significant. Augustine's not there when he dies. He was away from him. And that may have made the sting a bit harder. In chapter 9, we see the real depth of his grief. He says, the sorrow of this overshadowed my heart, and whatever I looked at was death. My hometown was an agonizing punishment for me, and my father's house a place of bizarre misery. And all the activities I'd shared with him turned, without him, into a monstrous torture. My eyes searched everywhere eagerly for him, but he wasn't presented to them. I hated everything. because nothing had him in it. And nothing could now say to me, look, he's coming, as things did while he lived and wasn't in my company. I became my own elaborate investigation, and I grilled my soul as to why it was sad and why it threw me into such terrible distress. But it didn't have any answer. If I tried saying to it, hope in God, it was right in not obeying me. Because the man it had loved devotedly and lost was more real and better than the figment in which it was commanded to hope. Right? God was just a figment to him at this point. And so saying hope in God was worthless. Only weeping was pleasant to me, and that had taken my friend's place as my heart's delight. He's devastated by this loss. Chapter 10, he meditates on what is grief? Why do we cry? Where is God in our grief? Right? He's wrestling with these issues. Chapter 11, he describes the friendship that he had with this individual as being two parts of one whole. Right? They were two halves of one soul. He says, but why am I discussing these things? Now is not the occasion for an inquiry, but for giving my testimony to you. I was wretched, and every mind is wretched when chained to friendship with things bound to die, and is torn to shreds when it loses them. That's when it feels the anguish that actually afflicts it long before it loses them. He's starting to recognize that if we put our ultimate devotion into something finite, it will always end in grief. It has to. Everything has an end. Now, interestingly, at the end of Augustine's life, he writes a book of retractions where he goes back through his works and says, okay, where did I get it wrong? And there are two retractions from the Confessions. One is from book 4 and in this chapter. And he says, in the fourth book, after I confessed the misery of my soul at the time of the death of a friend, still he doesn't name the friend, which is interesting, saying that in some manner our soul has been made one from two. He says, I say, and therefore perhaps I was afraid to die, lest the one whom I had loved so much should wholly die. Right? If we are two halves of one part, and he's died, if I die, he completely dies. But as long as I'm still alive, he's still here. And Augustine, looking back on this, says, this seems to me, as it were, a trifling pronouncement rather than a serious confession, although this absurdity may be moderated to some extent by the word perhaps, which I added. He says, I probably overstated the case a little bit in reflecting on that. Going on chapter 12, he's just a big sack of misery at this point. He says, what an insanity of ignorance, the inability to keep human affections on a human scale. That line alone is worth meditating on. And this is how he describes himself. I seethed, I sighed, I sobbed. I turned myself inside out, and I had neither rest nor access to reason. I hauled around with me a gouged and gory soul, which itself had had quite enough of this, but I couldn't find a place to put it down. Right? He's trying to get over this grief. He says, not in scenic groves, not in sports and music, not in fragrant spots, not in well-appointed dinner parties, and not in the sensuality of the bed and the couch, and not, would you believe it, in books and poetry. Everything repelled me, even daylight itself, and everything with a being apart from him was obnoxious and offensive, except for groaning and tears, and these alone was a scintilla of rest. He says, to where could my heart run away from my heart? Right? He says, wherever I go, I'm still there, and the grief is still there. Where can I go? Then he says, yet I did run from my hometown. My eyes were going to look for him less in a place where they weren't used to seeing him. He says, there's too many things in Thagaste that remind me of him. I'm going to go somewhere else, and hopefully that will help me forget him. So where does he go? He goes back to Carthage, the big city, where all the diversions are. That'll help. chapter 13, oops, I went too far. Chapter 13, he mentions that time to some degree heals all wounds, though it heals them lightly. And again, he has this beautiful line. He says, time doesn't take any time off. Doesn't roll idly through our perceptions. Instead, it does astonishing work in the mind. Right? There is some truth that time heals some grief. Now, how was Augustine's grief dampened by his time in Carthage? Because it was dampened to some degree. It was dampened by spending time with other friends. Distractions. Yeah, he said we had conversation. We shared jokes, made obliging exchanges of favors, read beguiling books together, were silly together and serious together, were at odds from time to time, but without resentment, as a person might be at odds with himself. We actually spiced up a plethora of shared opinions with just a sprinkling of differences. We exchanged teaching and learning, felt put upon when missing those who weren't there, and were elated at having them back. Right? So over time, spending time with other friends and other pursuits, his grief abated. In chapter 14, he's again meditating on this, and he flows back and forth between talking about kind of what he was thinking and then offering some mature reflection on it. And he has this line, which is kind of more mature reflection. In chapter 14, he says, it's a happy person who loves you, God, and in you loves his friend and loves his enemy because of you. The only one who never loses anyone dear to him is the one to whom everyone is dear to him and him who can't be lost. Again, that's another line well worth meditating on. If you want to never lose those dear to you, love them in God, because he can never be lost. Chapter 15, he speaks of the limitations of created things. Everything created changes. As much as we might want things to stay the same, everything changes. And everything earthly eventually passes away. And so fixing our focus and our hopes and our dreams on earthly things will always end in ruin, because they will always end in ruin. But what doesn't change is God. In chapter 16, there's another line that's really worth thinking about. He says, place in safekeeping with the truth whatever you possess from the truth, and you won't lose anything. This is another way of saying what Jesus said in the Sermon on the Mount, do not lay up for yourselves treasures on earth where moth and rust destroy, where thieves break in and steal, but lay up for yourselves treasures in heaven where neither moth nor rust destroys and where thieves do not break in and steal. If you want to never lose anything, entrust to God what God has given you and it'll never be lost. Chapter 17, he talks about the limits of the body. Skip through that and get to chapters 18 and 19. Chapters 18 and 19 are probably the most beautiful section in this book, and I'm going to read this in its entirety, or almost its entirety. Here, Leland Ryken says, the speech is nothing less than an outline of the gospel and an appeal to confess Christ as Savior. Augustine says that true love seeks to bring others along with us to God. Like, if we truly love someone else, then our goal should be to bring them to God with us. Now, that's the exact opposite of what Augustine did for this unnamed friend. He led him away from God. But reflecting back upon this as a mature man, he says, the best thing we can do for a friend is lead them to God. And he says, this is what we should say to them, that he is the one we must love, God. He made these things, and he is not far away. He didn't make them and take his leave, but rather they come out of him and exist in him as well. Just look, he's there, wherever you can taste the truth. He's in the inmost part of the heart, but the heart has wandered away from him. Return to the heart, you double crossers, and cling to the one who made you. Stand with him, and you'll stand indeed. Rest in him, and restfulness will be yours. Where are you going on that steep, rough road? Where are you going? The good that you love is from him, but only in as much as it's directed back toward him is it good and sweet. Otherwise, it will turn bitter, and rightly so, because it's not right to love whatever is in him while abandoning him. It's another important line. It's not right for us to love anything that God has given us if we don't love him. With what destination in mind are you walking? Endlessly on those hard paths of suffering. There's no rest where you're looking for it. Look for what you're looking for. Right? You're looking for something right. You're looking for a happy life. He says, but it's not there where you're looking. You're seeking a happy life in a land of death. It's not there. How can there be a happy life where there isn't even life? Our life, in person, came down here and took on our death and killed it with his own overflowing life. And he spoke like a thunderclap, shouting for us to return to him from here and enter that secret place from which he came forth to us. Coming first into the virgin womb itself, where the creation that was humankind became his bride, so that the dying body wouldn't always have to die. From there he came forth like a bridegroom out of the bedroom, and he was thrilled like a giant with a race to run. He lost no time, but ran with shouts of words, acts, death, life, descent, ascent, all the time shouting for us to return to him. He departed from our sight so that we would return to the heart and find him. He parted from us, and look, here he is. He was unwilling to be with us long, but he didn't leave us. He withdrew to a place from which he never drew back. In taking on his humanity, Christ did not give up his deity. He didn't leave heaven to come to earth. He's omnipresent. He withdrew to a place from which he never drew back because the universe was made by him, and he was in this universe, and he came into this universe to save sinners. To him my soul confesses, and he heals it, since it sinned against him. Sons of men, how long will you be heavy-hearted? Even after the descent of life, would you be unwilling to ascend and live? But where do you have to climb to, since you've already exalted yourselves and set your loud mouths up sky high? Come down so that you may go up, and you can go up to God. You fell by climbing up to try to challenge God. And he says, tell them this, so that they will wail in the valley of wailing and carry them off along with yourself to God, because you say these things to them out of his spirit, if in speaking you burn with the fire of selfless love. Now, if you're looking for some gospel in the confessions, there it is. All right. Tons to meditate on. We've got to hurry. Chapter 20. He is meditating on why do we love the things we love, what makes something beautiful, and he writes a book, because he writes lots of books. He writes a book called On the Beautiful and the Fitting. And we see in chapter 21 that he dedicates it to a man named Hierius, or however you want to pronounce that. Why does he dedicate that book to this man? Does he know this man personally? He's heard about him. He's a famous orator. Why are we influenced by the opinions of others? How does that work? Okay, there is an element that it causes us to think about things. Okay.
Which is to, because some celebrity or some quote important person likes this, we should like it.
Okay. So sometimes it causes us to think about things we haven't, sometimes it causes us not to think. But behind that, something else is being stirred. Our emotions are being stirred. And here's another line that really requires some meditation. He says, one lover sets on fire another. When we encounter somebody who's passionate about something else, sometimes that passion is caught. Can you think of any applications there for evangelism? Right. There is a sense that things are caught more than they're taught. Going on, chapter 22, he talks about love being based on human judgment and why that's insufficient. Chapter 23, he's infected by the passion of others for others. Again, he's thinking about this concept of, why do I like these people I don't even know? Right? Why do Swifties exist? Okay. Because some people get swept up in it, right? But almost none of them know her, right? But they're caught up in a feeling. They've caught a desire for something. And in chapter 23, he describes himself in similar language to what he did in book 2, where he was storm-tossed and on all this. He says, I was blown off course by the storm of my own arrogance and hauled around by every wind that hit me. Right? So he's just being carried along by his passions. Chapter 24, he views the world again. He's talking about his book that he's written, and he's talking about monads and dyads, and we won't go into that. But even he recognizes it was all nonsense at this point. Chapter 25, he talks about the necessity of God's light. He says, I didn't know at the time that my thought had to be elucidated with a light from outside of it in order to make it a share in the truth, because my mind itself isn't the essence of truth, but rather you, Master, will light my light. God is the essence of truth. He is truth. In order for our minds to be enlightened, they have to be lit from somewhere outside of us. Right. Do you think there's any implications there for evangelism? In evangelism, we're not primarily trying to convince people of an argument. And we can't convince them. Their minds have to be enlightened. Chapter 26, he talks about bizarre lunacy. And again, in that chapter, he's wrestling with two primary theological issues. What is evil? And what is God? Because he's trying to think of God in creaturely terms. And then chapter 27, he talks about the weight of his own uppityness. He says he was pulled down by the weight of his own uppityness. He's conceited. He's arrogant. He thinks he's a know-it-all. He is a know-it-all. And that blinds him from seeing the truth. Then in chapters 28 through 31, he comes in contact with another book. And we actually have this book. This is Aristotle's work, The Ten Categories. The Ten Categories is essentially a book that tries to classify everything that exists. Right? So there, you can put it in one of those ten categories. And Augustine really understood this work, or seemed to grasp it, but his students didn't. Right? We kind of see Augustine's a really sharp guy. He's really smart, and he knows it. Then in chapter 29, he's failing to understand what God is, because he's trying to fit God into one of these ten categories, and it's not going well. Right? He's trying to understand what is God. Then in chapter 30, he mentions the speed at which he seems to understand everything, humanly speaking. He says, anything in the science of speaking and debating and geometry, music, and mathematics, I understood without great difficulty, and nobody in the world needed to convey it to me. You know this, God, my master, because both speed and understanding and sharpness of discernment are gifts from you. He said, he was arrogant at this time with his great learning, and that great learning was a gift of God. But he wasn't using it rightly. And that's where he ends in chapter 31. He's got a brilliant mind. I mean, he's consuming things that his other professors are wrestling with, and he seems to have no trouble understanding it. His students can barely parrot back to him his own interpretations because they don't seem to understand it, but he gets it. And not just poetry and writing, but geometry and music and pretty much anything he picks up, he understands. But at the end of the day, he says that brilliant mind was a waste because it wasn't directed towards God. Now, what are some applications that we can pull out of this? I think one of the first ones is that we should not try to squeeze the infinite out of the finite. This is one of the things that Augustine is wrestling with as he's thinking about this death of a friend. And we really do need to keep human affections on a human scale. That this is really important. And as we go through, you're going to see Augustine's maturity in this. As he matures and becomes a believer, he was distraught at the death of this unnamed friend. When his mother dies, whom he is far closer with, he cries very briefly. He sees his son weeping, and he recognizes this is not the way a Christian should grieve, and he stops crying. You know, it's a dramatic contrast there. So don't try to squeeze the infinite from the finite. Another application is that evangelism really is one lover setting on fire another. It's not just communicating certain truths, but communicating a love. And lastly, those blind to spiritual truths must have their minds enlightened by God, or they will remain blind. I think all through this, Augustine recognizes, I might have been the smartest person in the world, and I was on the way to hell. If God had not redeemed me, then I would have been lost. Any other applications or thoughts or questions?
Certainly
get the idea of I think one of the most important things we can take away from Augustine is the importance of love. Right? Not just love amongst our friends and neighbors and family, but that at its root, we are called to love God. As unbelievers, our primary problem is not knowledge. It's a lack of love for God. In fact, Scripture says we hate Him. And in conversion, it's not that we're assenting to certain truths. It's not that we've been convinced with an argument. It's that we have a new love. We have a new heart that has new desires and new affections. And you'll see that woven all throughout Augustine. And he comes to a greater and greater appreciation of who God is and of a greater appreciation of love for Him. One last question, we'll end here. Why do you think Augustine doesn't name this friend and he never names his mistress? He's with his mistress for like 14 years, has a child by her. She's effectively a common law wife. He never names her. He never names this friend who died. Yet he named Nebridius in this really brief chapter because he rebuked him about astrology. Why doesn't he name these two individuals? I don't have an answer.
They stand for something. There are prototypes that a lot of people fit. He doesn't want to narrow it down to this is an individual issue. This is a human issue.
I think there's that. There's a generalizing of it because of that. Every commentator that reads Augustine asks this question and offers some answer. Here's my answer. I think for Augustine, these two were the biggest idols in his life. And more than anything else, he was trying, the human affections he had for these two individuals were far out of human proportion. And so he's hesitant to even name them because he realizes how attached he was to them. Maybe that's true, maybe it's not, I don't know. But it is a fascinating thing. We'll see a lot more of his mistress and his son as we move forward. So we're out of time, so let's go ahead and close in prayer.